So welcome back to the show, Bim. Last month we made the call not to record after the tragedy of what happened to Sir David Amess. Has it been a tough period for all in Parliament with this terrible event hanging over everybody?
The short answer is yes, because I think everybody just, it just makes people feel vulnerable in a way that they don't normally do. So I think the short answer is yes, it has been difficult, but ultimately, and I'm speaking just after his memorial service. So there was an original sort of funeral service, and then there was a memorial service today. Ultimately, I think people just taking a few extra precautions, being a bit careful about announcing where they're going to be ahead of time and that sort of thing. And I'm doing that. But broadly speaking, you've got to, the show must go on. Not that politics is a game show, because politics is very important and serious, but you know what I mean.
Yes, yeah, of course. And I think that's, you know, what Sir David would have wanted as well, not to stop politics or anything, because then, you know, these people who want to upset the system win. But let's move it to Sir David. What were your memories of him, you know, as a fellow Conservative member?
I didn't know him that well, but he did have an office near mine in my first 2 years, and so we used to chat. I think the thing I would say about him is that he was just quite a serious person. You know, he always had serious things he was doing in Parliament with people and trying to get things done. He wasn't one for like fripperies, or actually wasn't one for sort of, you know, he wasn't one hanging around in the bars late at night or anything. You know, he was quite a serious person, had real things to do, but always did it with a smile on his face in a very lighthearted way. So a serious person who didn't take himself too seriously, which I think is the way I put it.
It's an interesting insight to him. And of course, everybody here at Radio Verulam extends our condolences to his family. But going forward, Bim, you've kind of highlighted a little bit, and already you said that you've had to change the way that you're acting because of protecting yourself. But what do you believe needs to be done to avoid something like this occurring in the future without kind of upsetting what I think is one of the most unique and amazing facets of British parliamentary politics, is how close you are to constituents as well?
I mean, the truth is there's a limit to what you can do, and anyone who thinks that there isn't, I don't think understands how politics has to work. So you cannot shut yourself off from constituents at all times. Not even presidents or popes can do that. Ultimately, you have to be around. Our constituencies are broadly, you know, by any international standard, quite small. And so as a result, you're going to know people you're going to be around. What I do think you can do is, as I said, not announce where you're going to be ahead of time to the whole world on your website, for example. You can make sure not to meet people who you don't know in rooms where there is nobody else. There are some practical things you can do, but ultimately you sort of just have to go out and about and do your business, really.
And just maybe a final question on this. Have you ever felt unsafe as an MP? I asked Bambos this, I'll ask Daisy this, but have you ever been put in a position where you thought, oh gosh, I'm actually in a bit of danger here?
Only once. And that was at a charity event, which is odd because you'd think, why would somebody put you in danger at a charity event? And there were a lot of people around. So I didn't think I was going to be killed, but I did that somebody was incredibly angry and was, I think, had mental illness problems, though I can't confirm that. And really started sort of shouting and getting very physically aggressive. I had to move back several times. And then people had to pull this person away. Now, for me, that was quite threatening because you just don't really know what's in someone's hand. And if somebody's willing to get that angry, then they're probably angry enough to stab you or something. So that was the only time I felt unsafe. But broad, other than that, no.
Well,
I'm a young guy. So, you know, young people always think they'll live forever and they never feel unsafe, right? So, you know, I suspect you ask me in a few years, I might feel differently.
Yeah. And I mean, I hope that doesn't happen again. But obviously, this is almost the sad reality of working as a politician. Let's move it, though, to, I think it is a difficult topic because it's one of the biggest ones over the last months, is the second jobs scandal and a debate over if MPs should have second jobs at all. We've previously talked about you working a second job whilst in Parliament. First of all, what do you do to make sure that this does not impede your ability to serve your constituents, Bim?
Well, the way I put it is this. Parliament is, being a member of Parliament isn't a job like others. You effectively end up choosing your own hours. You end up choosing what to engage with and what not to engage with. There is literally no member of Parliament, for example, who conducts in-depth scrutiny of every single piece of legislation. That would not be possible. There is no member of Parliament who speaks in every single debate. That would not be possible. There's no member of Parliament who goes on telly or radio every single day. That would not be possible. So ultimately, you're having to balance all these things out. And you also work weekends, right? So I'm always doing something to do with my parliamentary duties on Saturday and quite often on Sundays, though not always, probably 50-50 on Sundays, Saturdays and Sundays. And so really what you do is you fit around that other things you might do. So for example, there are colleagues who are lawyers. There are colleagues who are doctors. There are colleagues who have family businesses that they keep ticking over. There are colleagues I know who are accountants, give accountancy advice. I am a non-exec director of a company, which means that, you know, I will be engaged in that to some degree for a few hours every week, normally 2 or 3 hours a week, no more than that. And actually being a director is about taking responsibility for the broader commercial strategic direction of the business. My personal background was I was in the city, I was a lawyer, then a banker. So it's really commercial and strategic. It's not political. So it's commercial and strategic. I think that where people are giving political advice, that's where the problems could arise, because it becomes quite hard to separate out political advice that you're giving from what's going on in Parliament and speaking to your colleagues about the same thing. And then where does the commercial interest and the political interest sort of collide or cross over? That can all get quite tricky. It's not impossible to do. Lots of people have done it completely fairly for a very long time, but I just think in certain instances it can get tricky. The way I look at it is I do, as I say, as a non-exec of a company that provides apprenticeship services, we think about the commercial strategic direction of the business. When there's an acquisition of a new business, I, you know, very much spent a lot of my career doing mergers and acquisitions. So making judgments around how to do that is a critical part of this. None of this has anything to do with politics. And the benefit of all of this, the important thing is the benefit of all of this is that you're connecting with the real world. People always say they don't want career politicians who just spend all their time being in politics in the age of the year dot. And I happen to think people are right about that, because it means that you're connected with the real world and what's going on. And in addition, if and when you become a minister, ministers all have two jobs. They have the job as a minister, which is minister for the armed forces, for example, or minister for care and health, which if you looked at ministers' diaries, I think you'd see not a huge amount of time every week for constituency matters. It's just the nature of being a minister for the nation. And they seem to manage it fine. Their constituents seem to be able to get pretty good service because they have offices that work effectively and they work weekends and they do the other things that the rest of us do as well. So I think that being in Parliament is as much a position, it's a lifestyle. It's something that's 24/7, literally every single day you're doing it. It is not sort of a job that you log in and you log off, you know, at a particular time. And I think it's hard for people to fully appreciate that because most people have jobs where they log in, log off at particular points. So that's how I put it all.
You voted for reformation of the system, kind of analysing MPs and the ability to maybe voted for a system that you might be able to appeal certain judgments against certain MPs. And we previously talked about your feelings on actually the need for changing these rules. But would you like to maybe remind viewers of why you have these feelings?
Well, what you have with the Standards Commissioner is somebody who And this is, by the way, the role, not the individual. I want to be very clear about that. But somebody who acts as sort of policeman, i.e. investigating, the jury, in terms of determining what the sentence is, sorry, determining whether someone's guilty or not, and then the judge determining the sentence. And the person under investigation has no ability in that process to change that process, to persuade the standards commissioners to do it a different way, to explain where things have been done incorrectly. They have no ability to do that. The standards commissioner may choose to listen to them, but they may choose not to. And I think that is not something that would pass muster in any normal system. Now, the reason why it happens is because MPs ultimately decide how these things work. So it's not a normal system because it's, you know, it's to do with MPs. And I'm not saying it should be normal. It's very difficult to come up with a system that sits above MPs because MPs pass the law, right? So it's very difficult to do that. I think that it's very important that we have some sort of better appeals process in there, maybe an appeal to a judge or something like that, so that somebody has somebody under investigation has somebody to go to in the event of something going awry. Having said that, I think we made a mistake around the Owen Paterson thing. I think that we should never have had the two issues conflated at the same time. The whole point of them, by the way, the whole point of these issues was to try and separate them out, but the vote was done on the same day. And so as a result, we ended up with everything being focused on the Owen Paterson thing rather than being focused on the broader system. That was a mistake on our part, definitely. And we weren't, contrary to what the media said, we weren't actually voting to do anything to Owen Paterson. Owen Paterson's sentence, for want of a better word, was to stay the same, only subject to the new system that was going to be created. But we weren't overturning it. But look, you know, I think we all realised that we messed up. And I think when you mess up, say we got it wrong, and then we're going to try and work on a cross-party basis to get something right that's better.
I mean, this, you've kind of talked about it there, almost the opportunity or the moment in time, you know, that the party has been in power for 11 years and people ask the question, why did you not use previous opportunities? A lot of people pointed to a certain minister who has been accused of sexual problems within Parliament. Why wasn't it used for that opportunity there, which I think a lot of people may have got on board with as a better opportunity to safeguard a lot of people as well?
The short answer is I don't know. But sometimes in politics, the important can get crowded out by the urgent. And I think that that's what probably happened here.
Let's move it then to your kind of reaction to the Owen Paterson situation, because you have been fairly outspoken on it, because in the fallout, you said that the real complaint from the public is that I don't think that MPs and the government are doing their jobs effectively enough. Dare I say it, I think they're right. I think the role of an MP needs to be upgraded and improved. Would you like to discuss maybe what you feel needs to happen?
Yeah. I mean, as I say, I tried to put this in a broad context. Not, it wasn't a political point per se. It was about the whole system. It's my view that MPs both need more support, in terms of people to help everything from how we deal with legislation to running offices and constituency matters. But also, as MPs, we need to spend more time dealing with difficult pieces of legislation. We need to spend more time in committee. We need to spend more time in debate. The House of Commons, I think, should sit later. More time to actually examine these issues and think about them. And I think that's the sort of trade-off. So give MPs more support, but also, I think that means, you know, we need to spend more time doing some of these things. I think that sometimes what happens is that MPs, not sometimes actually, quite a lot of the time, when there's an important issue, as an MP, you realise it only very late, and then there's a mad scramble for 48 hours or 24, 48 hours to try and deal with the issue. Now, that is not an optimal scenario. What you should be having is having enough time that you are properly engaged with things for much longer. And the current processes of how Parliament works don't really allow that, because there's a lot that gets packed into a day. So I think that we need to upgrade that. I also think MPs need to be given more of a role thinking strategically in areas such as foreign policy or even monetary policy, and certain things to do, you know, fiscal policy, thinking broader, more strategically about what we're doing. Now, nothing stops an MP thinking strategically about what we're doing. What I'm saying is we need to embed that within the parliamentary systems much more. And these are all things we can do. And they're all things that we can do relatively easily. And I think that it would benefit everybody, both MPs themselves and the country, if we could do that. And for what it's worth, I also think that we need to set out much more clearly the demarcation between what MPs do, what the government does, what local government does, and different levels of local government do. Because I think there's a huge amount of confusion, and what you end up with is often MPs sitting on top of and interfering with local government processes, which don't help those processes. But people come to the MP because they somehow feel that that's where the redress needs to come. And sometimes that is true, but at other times it's not. So I just think we need to look at the whole system and think, how can we get this to work a bit more effectively?
It's a fair point in terms of the local government and the parliament issues, because quite often we get messages to give to you, to Bambos, to Daisy. And you just straight up often say, well, this isn't my area, but do this, 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 and this. And it'll be interesting to kind of see how that plays out. The follow-up to that then, I guess, is will you or the government be working on changing that role? You know, you're quite keen on this issue. Is this something that maybe you'll spearhead yourself or maybe work with?
I am talking to colleagues about it. I think, as I say, that the issue, as you'll be aware, bearing in mind what happens in politics and the press and everything, the issue is to try and get the time for people to engage with it, engage with an important thing, without forgetting the urgent things that come up every day that you have to deal with. And it's simply one of bandwidth, I think, to then have that broader conversation. But it is happening in different areas. You know, this morning I was speaking in the city to a bunch of financial services senior people. And in financial services, we're doing quite a lot on the regulatory front to engage much more with the regulators, for example. So you know, in a part, using Parliament to do that. So again, I think that there are definitely ways of us doing this.
I guess another analysis of the parliamentary system. The Prime Minister admitted he got it wrong. You said it as well in this interview. And he said on a clear road, he crashed the car into a ditch. But do you feel annoyance that you were whipped into supporting this proposal? Would you have opposed it if it wasn't put as a party whipped issue?
No, because I explained why I supported it. But it's really, really tough when you've got 365 or so quite opinionated, ambitious, individualistic people to get them to go through the same lobby on anything, particularly when it comes to a thorny issue like this. And I just think that that's why you need a party system that can keep people in the same group. I don't reject that. Without that system, it'd be almost impossible to get anything done ever. So, you know, I don't think this idea that, oh, no, we shouldn't whip people for anything. Well, you know, you wouldn't be able to achieve anything. You wouldn't be able to get anything built. Nothing would ever get done. No laws would ever get passed, because what you would get is you would get people going in 100 different directions. As a party, you've got to have a view on most things, and you've got to form that view through consultation and discussion. I think that we should do as much of that as possible. But ultimately, I think it's important as a party, you generally have a view on things and you try and get them done. Because when it comes to the general election, nobody says, oh, on vote 37 of 2021, you didn't vote with the government, but on vote 89, you did. Why? I mean, nobody does that. Ultimately, the Conservative Party and the Labour Party are going to get judged on their broad record and what they've broadly been saying. So I think it's important that as a team, you stay together. The way that you really, really try and get the outcome that you personally might want is through the internal party structures, especially.
let's move it then on to another parliamentary discussion. And it's 103 years since Parliament allowed women to stand as MPs. But since then, of the 5,000 MPs who have been elected, only 556 have been women. Even now, Parliament is less than 40% women. What do you believe needs to happen to move towards greater gender equality, Bim?
Well, the first thing is for people not to hound women on social media when they're in politics. Women get that much worse than men do. And, you know, so if people care about this, then they shouldn't pile into women on social media, frankly, which quite a lot of people do. And of course, they won't admit it, but that is what they do. And that would probably have more of an impact than anything else. That's the first thing. Second thing is we've got to take we've got to take a look at, as I say, the role of MPs, I've already discussed, because in my experience, a lot of the women who come into politics are particularly keen on less on the game playing and more on the broader strategic systemic things that happen. Not always. There are men who care about that and there are women who care about game playing. But broadly speaking, I think you find that. And I think if we could convey a more longer term and less sort of histrionic atmosphere, then I think you'd get more women. And so I think that's something else we can do. And then also I think with parties, and I can't speak for other parties because I don't know them obviously very well, but I know in the Conservative Party, we've made huge strides in this regard. You know, we've had two women prime ministers. You know, no other party can say that. And there's a reason for it, because we ultimately don't really care people's color or gender or whatever. And I think the other parties probably need to catch up. Now, paradoxically, I think what the Labour Party have done with all women shortlists is a huge mistake, because what you end up with is you end up with quotas. And when you have quotas, inevitably there will be instances, quotas of any type, there will be instances where the best person to do a particular job at a particular time is not the quota you're optimizing for, whether it be women, ethnic minorities, any other type of sort of particular minority. Now, that creates a huge amount of resentment on the group that have been forced out. And that group, significant numbers of able people just don't play. They just don't play the game and they don't enter and you don't see them. And what that does is it creates a real resentment and it also creates a feeling amongst some. And I've had women say this to me in Parliament. They say, oh, well, people just say I'm only here because I'm a woman. Now, in fact, quite a lot of these women are not here because they're women. They're here because they're very, very able. But if you've had a quota system for them to be there, that issue will be there for some. And I think that, you know, there's a famous US Supreme Court case, and I forget what it was, but it was about affirmative action in the US for African-Americans. And the Supreme Court Chief Justice, John Roberts, I think it was one of his early cases. And the way he put it was, the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. And I happen to agree with that. So, you know, if we don't want discrimination, then let's not have it. Let's not say that it's okay for some areas and not okay for others. Because I think conceptually and ideologically, you get into real tricky waters.
So let's move it to some things that you have been really involved in, Bim. And as chair of the APPG, the UK Parliamentary Renewable and Sustainable Energy, it was COP26 this month. Were you encouraged by the conclusion of the talks, or did you feel let down that the commitment to green energy sources were not signed and ratified by all members there, and that maybe the 1.5 Celsius target is likely not to be met?
It's very difficult, this, because of course I'd like it to have been stronger. Most people would have liked it to have been stronger. But I'm not going to sit here and just blame China and India, for example. And the reason why I don't want to blame China and India is if you go to China or India, you will see significant poverty in many places, despite the fact that those countries have got a lot richer over the last 20, 30 years. Now, if you were running a country with significant poverty and richer countries, which, by the way, have represented the broad majority of the greenhouse gases that are still in the atmosphere, and richer countries are telling you, no, you guys need to stop pumping out, you know, hydrocarbons, you turn around and go, hold on. We've got people in poverty. We're trying to lift our people out of poverty. That's why I'm in politics, if I'm a politician in India or China. That's why they're there in politics. And to say, so to see the difficulty, so it's very, very important that what we do is we make it easy and financially sensible for poorer countries, or countries that are still developing, should I say, to use green technology. That needs to be our focus. And if we can absolutely focus on that, and as a country in Britain, we need to do that, but not just Britain, across the West, and we give finance, both governments and financial institutions give money to poorer countries in order to do this, not just free money, but exactly tied to energy generation or other things. That's how we'll fix this problem. Because the COP process is important because it establishes an important dialogue, and it means that you've got to have a lot of commitments. But there is a real difficulty with forcing those commitments, because countries are sovereign. And the way of helping these commitments be met is by making it easy for countries to make these commitments, not just bashing them over the head saying, you need to reduce your carbon emissions. You know, so that's, I think, the next stage is we need to really work on that, making it as easy and financially sustainable as possible for countries to do things greener.
Well, this is something that you actually doubled down on and brought to the attention of the Prime Minister directly in the House of Commons. You asked about plans to ensure that, you know, globally, that these targets were met on issues such as funding as quickly as possible. Were you encouraged by his response?
I was. I mean, it was interesting because I spoke to him after that debate, and he sort of said, look, you know, I know we're working on it. You know, it's an important issue. But, you know, we are the presidents of COPs, but there are, I don't know, 180 countries or whatever. Britain isn't in charge of them all. It's a very tough business. And Alok Sharma, who got international praise for the work he did, you know, I've been closely in touch with Alok. My APPG did the parliamentary liaison for COP. So I was very close with him and his team, and he really did a fantastic job, and he did his best.
Adding to this, you've also been working on the Environment Act. You said it will positively affect your local constituents. Could you explain maybe what this impact will be?
The Environment Act is huge. I want to point to two things. One is something called local nature recovery networks. So it does what it says on the tin. It's to recover nature in every single local area, and local authorities having to put together plans to show how they're going to recover nature in every single area. I think that's really important. The second is something biodiversity net gain. And biodiversity net gain is the new principle we're establishing whereby if any biodiversity is destroyed for building of anything, whether it be a house, a road, a railway line, whatever, that has to be offset either on site, which is the first preference, or somewhere else, not too far away, as best, as close as possible, by biodiversity. So if you destroy an acre of biodiversity, broadly speaking, you have to put an acre of biodiversity in. And I think that principle is so important for a country like ours, which is a comparatively densely populated island, for us to do it. But one thing that when I was looking at this and thinking about it, that I didn't realize until quite recently, is if you compare us to 200 years ago, England has twice as many forests in terms of land covered by forest, twice as much land covered by forest as it did 200 years ago. Scotland has four times as much land as covered by forest as it did 200 years ago. And the reason for that, of course, is if you look at in the Industrial Revolution, the amount of just timber felling that was done and clearing of land for agriculture, bearing in mind agriculture wasn't nearly as efficient. We didn't have the machines you have now, et cetera, meant you need a lot more land to produce the same amount of food as we do now. So that was the reason for it. But I thought that was quite interesting. So not everything is worse. Though, by the way, I don't want to put too shiny a gloss on it. Quite a lot of the stuff is. And that's why we need biodiversity net gain and local nature recovery networks. But I just thought that was quite an interesting fact.
Yeah, that is a fascinating fact. You know, I'm sure people are learning a lot from the interview today, as always. But that is, it kind of flips the narrative of maybe everything is bad and everything is going wrong. You had discussions, though, this month with the leader of North Harts Council, and maybe going back to what we discussed earlier about, you know, how you can help maybe influence local issues, but sometimes it's not under your remit. But what did you discuss and what progress was made?
We broadly discussed two things. One was Churchgate and what's going on with that in Hitchin. And hopefully in due course, we'll have some updates on that in terms of, and this is a shopping center part of, it's a small shopping center in the center of Hitchin, which I think everybody agrees needs redeveloping. And I've done some work on it in the past. And so hopefully we're getting somewhere with that. And then the second thing is we discussed the local plan, which is all about housing delivery and commercial buildings, but mostly housing delivery in North Hertfordshire, and really just urging the planning inspector to come back on that as soon as possible. So they were the two broad things we discussed.
And a final one for me before we move to the community questions. You had a visit to Grove Junior School. You also gave a tour around the House of Commons to some sixth formers as well. How much do you enjoy these visits and kind of teaching the younger generation about politics?
I love it because I love the sound of my own voice. So why wouldn't I? but it's great because you often get tougher questions from kids because they don't start with the preconceptions. So you often get very direct, quite tough questions from kids. So no, I love it. Very much enjoy it.
I mean, did you have any funny questions? Because when I talked to Daisy recently, she got asked what was the Queen's favourite Star Wars character. I mean, very important questions like that are asked by children. Did you have any?
Really? I always get asked, you know, who's the most important person that you've met? Which always makes me feel bad, because obviously that means I'm obviously not that important enough. So they need to think of who actually important have I met. So that I have been asked that quite a few times, interestingly.
Oh, and so, yeah. Did you mention me at all?
No, I didn't, unfortunately.
Oh, well.
I did not mention you.
See, now we've both been insulted in this in this interview. But I guess the whole point of me asking you this as well was, you know, for younger generations, I'm sure you've inspired a lot of people there. And maybe some of them will get into a career in politics. Others might just, you know, try and better their areas. Who was your political influence or inspiration when you were younger, though?
Oh, it's a very good question, that. Honestly, I didn't really have one. I didn't have one person who came to school or whatever. I saw lots of politicians. I actually think that the biggest influence on me was to meet quite a few politicians in my teens and to realise that they weren't sort of extraordinary. It was to realise that these were, you know, often quite able people, intelligent people, but they weren't fundamentally different to me or my friends or people I knew. And that gave me the confidence to know that I could do the job. I think that is quite important. You've got to fundamentally think you can do it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, talking to politicians regularly, like I do, it is quite interesting to see, obviously, you're all very driven and have these amazing ideas, but at the same time you are just people like the rest of us and should be treated as such in probably a fairer manner as well. But let's move.
I agree, be fairer to politicians, that's my motto.
Let's move to the community questions, though, and Michael has asked, do you agree that Oakman Group should be allowed to bring one of its branches to Harpenden at Kingston House? I believe it may threaten pubs and local restaurants owned by our people who have had a hard time suffering with COVID. What are your thoughts on that one, Bim?
The short answer is I don't know. It will depend on the details, but I'm very happy to deal with it if the constituent would email me about it, because it really depends on the details of that sort of thing.
Let's move it then to Sue's question, because like you said there, it's all about context and plans and things like this. She's asked, this month, you talked about people's worries over mask mandates in certain situations at Hertfordshire schools. She's quoted, you said it's important that we take appropriate actions to combat the spread of COVID-19 and keep people safe. But she's asked, why is this not shared by your party in the House of Commons? Many were critical of the Leader of the House of Commons, Jacob Rees-Mogg's comments last month that Conservative MPs don't need to wear masks during debates because they know each other and that you share a convivial fraternal spirit meant they were acting in line with government guidance. Do you disagree with your fellow party member here?
His view of this is really one of... it's twofold. It's the sense that if you're dealing with people who you see a lot of, so people in your workplace who you see every single day, there is not necessarily the same need to feel threatened by COVID as somebody who you've never seen before. So that's really the principle he's talking about. The broader point around the House of Commons is a fair one. And I think that, you know, a majority of my colleagues do wear them in the chamber, but there is an issue of just basic freedom. We are not forcing other people in the country to wear masks anywhere. We're not forcing them, though it's advised in certain instances, and therefore we can't force them in the House of Commons. That's the broad principle. And for people who say, well, we should force people, I think that what we've got to do is get back to a point where we aren't just mandating things all over the place, because that is not the way our society should work. We should not be in a society where people are constantly bossed around by government. But of course, government has a very strong role in saying, this is what we advise you to do for these reasons. I think that philosophically, it's very important that we go more towards that rather than ordering everybody around all the time, especially after we've been through a vaccination program and indeed the booster program that's going out now.
Do you feel that it's more of an example, though, if all members or maybe more of them were to encourage that sort of action? Because obviously the understanding is, as you've explained there, it's freedom of choice. But maybe part of the problems of certain spikes have been because people have chosen not to wear the masks. And if their political leaders follow suit and show that they want to wear their masks, then people might follow as well. Do you believe that maybe there needs to be a more concentrated on effort on that, leading by example, Bim?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been sceptical about this idea that people look at politicians and go, oh, they're doing it, I must do it too. I've never been persuaded by this. That is not to say that we shouldn't do it. As I said, a majority of my colleagues do, I do. But... you know, the leading by example point, I've never thought really works. I think it's generally people who want something happening, and they say, oh, well, you need to lead by example, even if you're not going to mandate it. I just don't think that's how people relate to their politicians.
Gemma has moved the discussion back to something in the local area, although she said maybe it's less of a Hitch and Harpenden problem, but I've seen a growing number of empty shops. You said this week that you had a meeting with Rishi Sunak over support for local businesses. What commitments can you make for local businesses owners like myself?
Well, the first thing is we're cutting business rates big time by 50% for retail and hospitality businesses. And that was the first thing Rishi said when I spoke to him at number 11. So, you know, that is the first thing I'd say. And the second thing I'd say is we're doing a consultation on online sales tax. We're looking at the broader business rates regime. It's really important that we get tax right for small and medium-sized businesses. That's the first thing. On the other hand, what I'd also say is we need to continue the work at a local level to improve the state of the high streets and town centres, because that can't be mandated from government. That can only be done locally. And that's also the work that I'm doing.
And I guess as well for local business owners in the area, maybe going back to the earlier point from Michael as well, is do you worry that because of the effects of COVID that maybe some of the unique character of Hitchenden and Harpen might be lost because, you know, branch businesses come in, or are you not too worried about that, Bim?
I'm always worried about that. But I think over the last few months, the shops and the businesses in Hitchin and Harpenden have shown themselves to be resilient and successful. And I'm hopeful that we'll continue in that vein.
Neil has brought it onto Little Womanly, and he's talking about defibrillators. Little Womanly. It's good that you know all the pronunciations of the local areas, Bim.
That's sort of like job requirement. Part one.
Yeah. So with respects to Little Womanly, as you've corrected me, he's talking about the area getting a defibrillator, but he's asked, why are there not more commonplace? Would you back funding devices around the whole of your constituency? And he's also asked a follow-up question. Also, have you ever been first aid trained?
Have I been first aid trained? Yes, but a long time ago. So I'm not sure how effective my training would be now, which means I should probably do it again. And then the first point, we're getting one in Little Womanly. We're also getting one in Peter's Green, which is near Kempton in the centre of the constituency. And, you know, I'm hopeful that this will grow and mushroom all over the constituency, because defibrillators are very important things. They can save lives.
And just in terms of defibrillators, then, is there kind of a Harpenden Hitchin almost listing of where all these places are? I mean, how is the best way that you can go about finding, in an emergency situation, finding a defibrillator?
This is a very good question to which I have no idea. Okay. So it is actually a very, very, very good question, and I will endeavour to put that together, because I don't know.
Yeah. You know, maybe something that we can put on social media as well. If you find that information, we can share that or put it in the description when this goes out as a podcast. Getting into the final couple of questions here, Tina has pointed out that it was World Mental Health Day. As someone who has a stressful job, Bim, and criticism from the public, how do you stay in charge of your mental health? And do you have any tips?
There's a difference between mental health and mental well-being. I put mental health in the clinical box, and I don't have any problems in that regard, touch wood. In relation to mental well-being, in terms of just being healthy, being in a good place mentally, or words to that effect is how I describe it. I think a key aspect is to have other things in your life, whether that be family, friends, hobbies, etc., and I've got lots of that, to be able to not care that much. I know that sounds a very odd thing to say, but you've got to be able to just tune out noise, because otherwise it would drive you mad. And the last thing, though it's a very strange thing for a politician to say, I don't really read newspapers very much. I actually there's just so much nonsense in them most of the time. But I really don't read them that much. I find that it actually enables me to think a bit more clearly. If I don't spend a lot of my time reading newspapers, I will flick and see what's going on in the news headlines or whatever. But I don't spend too much time reading newspapers, because I think it can often distort your thinking. And you think that's reality, whereas actually reality is what's actually going on, what people say to you. What's going on, whether it be in the constituency or in Parliament or nationally. And so I try and not just be completely obsessed by what the press is saying.
And so let's move it to the last question. Hopefully it elicits a nice, positive response. Nick has asked, what is the best and the worst thing about being an MP?
The best thing is that you are constantly around really interesting people. I mean, politicians are interesting. And I've never worked in an environment like that. I've worked in very high power places, but it's not the same at all. Politicians, you just get such a rich tapestry of personalities and intelligence and drive. That is, I think, the best thing. And the worst thing is everything else. So I don't quite mean that. No, the worst thing, I think, is probably it's the over-reading into little words that you might say or throwaway remarks, which in any normal mode of speech, nobody would look into. But in politics can often become an issue of sort of report, and that can be a bit boring.
And I think one point as well, we obviously did a discussion about road safety. One of the points that you said in that interview, which I do recommend people to listen to just for some good tips and insight, but you raised the point as well that people often get angry at you, but they haven't told you what the problem is. You know, you've said to them, could you please email me about this problem? Have you told me about this before? And they've accused you of not doing anything, but you said you're not a mind reader. Is that probably up there as one of the worst things as well, Bim?
I actually completely forgot I said that, but that sounds like exactly the sort of thing I would say. So, yes, I think that can be irritating. Definitely.
Well, Bim, once again, thank you for the insights. Thank you for your time today. And we'll see you again next month. So people do get your messages in. You can email me, jason.mckenna@radioverulam.com. You can DM us and slide into our social media feed. But for now, Bim, I wish you the best of health, and we will see you again next month.
Thank you.